From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Kat Galvis.
This week on War News Radio, chaos and crisis.
First, we summarize the current civil war in Syria.
Next, we present our editorial segment, Filibusted.
Then we hear from youth protesters in Brazil, Turkey, and Egypt.
After, we examine the return of U.S. drone strikes in Yemen.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Egyptian Interior Minister Mohamed Ibrahim was the victim of an apparent suicide car bomb attack, an act that Ibrahim called a cowardly assassination bid. Although the minister was unharmed, two others were killed and more than 10 people were critically injured. The Egyptian government blamed the assassination attempt on the Muslim Brotherhood, a group the government has condemned for a number of civil uprisings in the past. The Muslim Brotherhood, however, has been quick to, quote, strongly condemn this particular incident and affirm their endorsement of nonviolent protest.
Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, announced plans this week to implement radical changes to the country's nuclear policy. Rouhani proposed shifting responsibility for nuclear negotiations away from the historically conservative Supreme National Security Council. The Iranian Foreign Ministry, headed by moderate Mohammad Javad Zarif, will now coordinate the talks. The United States, Russia, China, France, Great Britain, and Germany, the six countries who last negotiated with Iran unsuccessfully in April, seek to resume talks as soon as possible. Rouhani is scheduled to speak in front of the UN General Assembly in New York later this month.
Indian author Sushmita Banerjee was dragged out of her home in Afghanistan and killed by militants earlier this week. Banerjee was best known for her memoir, A Kabuliwala's Bengali Wife, which describes her escape from the Taliban in 1995. The best-selling book was later adapted into the Bollywood movie Escape from Taliban. While several sources have suggested that the militants responsible for Banerjee's execution were members of the Taliban seeking retaliation, the Taliban has not officially claimed responsibility for the murder.
Kenyan members of parliament voted this week to withdraw from the International Criminal Court. The decision came in the wake of ICC plans to try the president of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta, and the deputy president, William Ruto, for crimes against humanity. Both Kenyatta and Ruto have denied charges that they helped to orchestrate post-election violence resulting in over 1,200 deaths in 2007. In justifying their decision to pull out from the ICC, the Kenyan government cited many world leaders, including the United States, who are also not members of the ICC. Additionally, they highlighted an apparent anti-African bias in the ICC, which has prosecuted only Africans to date. Chief ICC Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, however, noted that Kenya is still obliged to abide by current ICC proceedings.
And now, reporter Colin Smith explores the current situation in Syria.
In late August, more than 1,400 Syrian civilians were killed in what the United States, United Kingdom, Germany, and others labeled a chemical weapons attack by the Syrian government. Although the country has been embroiled in civil war for over 2 years, this latest development sparked outrage from the West and prompted talks about military intervention. As a number of nations contemplated the costs of interceding in the conflict, the Syrian civil war quickly became the most salient topic in international affairs. At this week's G20 summit in Russia, global leaders began fierce debates on the merits of Western intervention, despite the fact that Syria was not originally on the official summit agenda. In a speech last Saturday, U.S. President Barack Obama announced his support for limited military intervention in Syria, framing the decision as one necessary both for national security and a broader obligation to international order.
This attack is an assault on human dignity. It also presents a serious danger to our national security. It risks making a mockery of the global prohibition on the use of chemical weapons.
This decision followed comments Obama made last August, in which he identified the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime as a red line that could not be crossed without consequences. However, commentators have pointed out that, despite his rhetoric about global codes of conduct, Obama's plan fails to provide solutions for the major issues at hand. In an interview on MSNBC, political science professor Dominic Tierney explains this problem.
How are we going to get Assad, for example, to negotiate? Is this really going to stop Assad from killing civilians, or will he simply stop killing civilians using chemical weapons and start going back to the tried and tested conventional weapons by which he killed many tens of thousands? So what is the strategy here? That is the piece that seems to be missing.
Instead, Tierney offers another rationale for the decision, credibility.
This is a war for credibility. America's credibility, Obama's personal credibility, the Democratic Party's credibility. At least that's how it's set up.
Arguments over intervention have also dominated discussions in the United Nations Security Council. Representatives from Russia and China voiced harsh opposition to any military strikes not done with UN approval, while U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry accused Russia, Syria's ally, of intentionally impeding consensus within the Security Council. In an attempt to circumvent stalled debate in the Security Council, Obama decided to focus debate on U.S. intervention to domestic actors. He urged Congress to approve a U.S.-led military intervention and an endorsement by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee of a resolution authorizing Obama to begin strikes marked the first steps toward congressional approval of limited military action. Amid ongoing discussions between the White House and congressional leadership in Washington, video footage on YouTube made public an attack by rebels on a Christian village near Damascus. The U.S. has consistently vocalized support for and supplied weapons to the rebels throughout the conflict, but this news of rebel brutality has added further controversy to the issue of American support and military involvement in the Civil War.
This is War News Radio. Sometimes, it's hard to read the news without getting angry. Caroline Batten and Sarah Morrell have stopped trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment dedicated to news that makes us tear our hair out.
So the Syrian civil war is poised to become a multinational conflict.
Although we won't see World War III if Iran can keep its nuclear program in its pants.
And you would think President Bashar al-Assad might be slightly concerned at the moment.
You know, after the death of 1,400 citizens in the suburbs of Damascus, over 2 million refugees flooding out of his country, and President Obama insisting on pointing cruise missiles at Syrian army strongholds.
But for Assad, just a day in the life when you're battling over 13 rebel groups who want your head on a plate, and you're using sarin gas on your own citizens.
In fact, the Assad family is conducting business as usual. Assad welcomed a Yemeni delegation to the country last week. According to the New York Times, he hosted them in the presidential palace, miraculously unshelled, and made cutting remarks about the situation in Egypt.
Also according to the Times, when one of the Yemeni delegates called deposed Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi a donkey, Assad said that was an insult to the animal.
Right, because Assad's doing so much better, the whole ruthless dictator thing.
Well, he is still in power, but it seems like he's doing everything he can to enrage his subjects.
The Assad Instagram feed is a riot.
Yup. Asma, Assad's wife, has been serving up a beautiful public relations campaign. I mean, hey, if your people are involved in a vicious civil war, at least you're helping out in soup kitchens. Her Louboutins are metaphorically stepping on the civilian lives lost to her husband's chemical weapons, but at least Vogue is impressed with her fashion choices. And yes, Vogue did in fact write an article about her in 2011 titled A Rose in the Desert.
Oof. Great title, better timing.
One particularly uncomfortable photo emphasizes her new $129 jawbone bracelet, which counts her calories and her sleep cycles for her. People are dying from chemical weaponry, but Asma al-Assad will never have to worry about a poor night's sleep.
34% of the Syrian population lives under the poverty line, and she's dieting. Dieting!
What else do you expect from a woman who sidestepped international sanctions to buy designer clothes and shoes?
Well, in other dictator-related news, Kim Jong-un, filibustered's favorite autocrat, is preparing to receive a representative of the United States.
And it's not Robert King, the actual U.S. ambassador for North Korean human rights issues.
It's NBA player Dennis Rodman. Again.
You know, the guy who loves referring to Kim Jong-un as my friend for life and going on basketball diplomacy tours.
Rodman insists he's on first-name terms with Kim Jong-un, saying in a May 7th tweet that he calls him Kim. Too bad Kim's not his first name. In Korea, the family name comes first.
He also said in the same tweet that he's going to ask Kim to, quote, do him a solid and cut Kenneth Bae loose. Bae is the American human rights activist and missionary who's been held in North Korea in a special prison since November 2012.
But apparently this trip isn't actually about Bae at all. During a Sports Illustrated interview in July, Rodman changed his position on using his bromance with Kim Jong-un as a political tool. Because, as Rodman puts it, quote, keeping us safe is really not my job. It's the black guy's job.
The black guy? You mean the President of the United States, maybe? I'd normally expect that kind of comment from Donald Trump.
Rodman would rather talk about basketball with his BFF, maybe since it's unclear what, if anything, he could actually do for Bae.
But Rodman thinks he's got pretty impressive political sway anyway. He told HuffPost Live, quote, if I actually got him loose, and I'm just saying this out of the blue, I'd be the most powerful guy in the world.
Actually, that would be the black guy.
Meanwhile, back in Egypt, Adli Mansour, the current interim president chosen by the Egyptian army, says that the country is, quote, moving toward democracy.
Did I miss something here? Last time I checked, there were hundreds of political detainees imprisoned by the Egyptian army, solely for belonging to the Muslim Brotherhood.
And the protest crackdowns don't really help his case either. 221 people were injured, and 8 people died at last Friday's protest alone.
Even better, Mansour says that he wants to help put Syria on the path to democracy as well.
Is that the same democratic path that Egypt's on right now?
I mean, no one's trying to claim that the path to democracy is quick or simple, but it normally doesn't involve deaths and ideological detainment.
But explosions are always my favorite first step towards institutionalized democratic reform.
Finally, in a just end to the sort of news that made us want to punch a wall, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales has finally been sentenced to life in prison for the murder of 16 Afghan civilians in March 2012, a killing spree now known as the Kandahar Massacre.
Yes, we can all breathe a sigh of relief knowing that the perpetrator of one of the worst American war crimes in recent memory is being duly punished.
But Sarah, his lawyers did such a good job defending the fact that he brutally beat women and children, gunned them down with his machine gun on burst, and set several of their bodies on fire.
Oh, right. However did they manage to explain away that point of contention?
Well, he was a loving father. And, they said, great with kids.
A stand-up friend, too.
However was he convicted with a justification like that? That definitely explains away the 9 witness testimonies, or the 7-year-old girl that he injured so badly she had to be taught how to talk again.
We'll never really know why he would do something this awful, since he offered us no explanation. But Bales has been dishonorably discharged and sentenced to life without parole.
Well, it's a shame we're out of time. I have a list of rage-inducing summer news longer than Asma al-Assad's bank statement.
Sounds about right. For Filibusted, I'm Sarah Morrell.
And I'm Caroline Batten. It's been a pleasure. At least for us. We'll be right back.
This is War News Radio. This summer saw civil unrest in the city streets of Turkey, Brazil, and Egypt. War News Radio reporter Sadie Rittman speaks with the protesting youths to share their experiences and perspectives.
This summer, between my freshman and sophomore year of college, I attended music festivals and county fairs in New York. I might describe the experience like this.
Everyone was happy.
It was really great, you know. It was like really positive, and that everybody was, you know, together for the same cause.
You can see every kind of people. You can see religious people. You can see gay people. You can see anyone in there.
But those people you just heard weren't fellow New Yorkers. And though their reflections seem to describe a kind of festival-like atmosphere, they certainly weren't celebrating music or deep-fried Oreos. That was Karim Sharif, Patricia Seysher, and Can Sokulu from Cairo, Sao Paulo, and Istanbul, respectively. And they spent their summers protesting for what they saw as the democratic falterings in their country. The feelings of togetherness, beauty, and hope that they got from their, shall we say, festivals, came at much higher stakes than mine.
It's quite like a festival. Seriously, you can see every kind of people just chatting, helping each other. And when the night is about to fall, police starts to attack, because at night it's really hard to get the things on camera. So police prefers attacking during nightfall.
A woman journalist was hit in the eye, and it was like photos all over the place of her with a big eye and bleeding and purple and everything.
Joyful place suddenly becomes a hell.
The protests that these young people became occupied with were sparked for different reasons, and yet Patricia, Can, and Karim seem to share a common democratic spirit. To explain the protests that began in Turkey on May 27th, Nedim Şener, a Turkish journalist who came to speak in New York, referred to Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan as an authoritarian father. He tries to control what the Turks read, how many children they have, and even what they eat. But Şener says that some kids don't like the spinach every night, and so they are protesting. The protests all started when this wayward father sought to take away Istanbul's Gezi Park, located in Taksim Square, which 24-year-old Can saw as an important symbol.
The reason why I was there is that Taksim is like a symbol for the secular people in Turkey, and their aim was destroying that symbol.
It seems that Erdogan did react to the peaceful sit-in in the park like an authoritarian father would, when his police force was sent to try to teach his kids a disturbing lesson.
The reason why really people gathered there was protecting the trees at first, until the police officers really attacked those people. We suffered a lot from the gas bombs, seriously. The thing that people should, that everyone should agree, is the police force. Yeah, they must protest that. That's the primary thing for me, but people are generally protesting against the government itself.
Being hit with gas bombs pushed Can and other protesting youths to become more politically aware, making them realize firsthand that perhaps Erdogan's democratic integrity is severely flawed.
He says that, how can I be a dictator? I came here with votes. But actually, there are many people that are being arrested every day. He wants more freedom for himself.
Brazil's mass protests, beginning on June 6th, were also sparked over a small-scale issue, an increase in bus fares. However, 19-year-old law student from Sao Paulo, Patricia Seysher, spoke to me about how the protests quickly broadened in scope to address larger social issues.
In the beginning, it was all just because of the public transportation price. But then people started talking about, there is not only about that, it's about education and health and everything that we need to work out here in our country, because we have a pretty bad situation.
Meanwhile, 22-year-old engineering student Karim Sharif of Cairo describes Egypt's mass protests from June 26th to July 3rd as a continuation of the country's Arab Spring protests from January of 2011.
everybody really wanted to change. Nobody wanted this tyrant ruler again.
Though protests in 2011 saw Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak ousted and Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood Party democratically elected, Karim and other protesting Egyptians didn't think that Morsi was adequately fulfilling the democracy that they'd strived for.
They want to tailor democracy on their own way.
Protesters succeeded in seeing Morsi removed from power, but unrest and controversies continued, especially around the question of whether it was really the people or a military coup that deposed Morsi.
I have friends, members in the Muslim Brothers, and they are pro-Morsi, and I totally respect their point of view. At the point when they say that it's a military coup, it's not.
Conversely, in Brazil, Patricia complains that the protests ended a little too abruptly when bus fares were negotiated back down, but the country's larger social questions were just forgotten.
I always say that Brazilian people have a short-term memory because it feels like everybody forgot what happened.
In Turkey, the story is quite different. Whereas in Brazil, the media was able to document and thus put a stop to much police violence, Reporters Without Borders refers to Turkey as the world's largest prison for journalists. The New York Times reports that since May, 72 journalists have been fired for covering protests. This means that the free press isn't really there to protect its citizens, and John says that without a free press to record their trials, protesters like him have been scared off the streets and onto Twitter.
I wasn't a Twitter user until the protests began, and now I am following a lot of people. For instance, I'm following every reporter that has been fired from their newspapers. I see warnings on Twitter that a police bus is coming by, so they may arrest. You should better get away from there. I'm getting warnings like that from Twitter as well. It's really crucial.
But even Twitter isn't safe from repression. John says that Turkish Twitter users click mark as spam to silence political opponents, and that they can't even hide behind a Twitter handle to speak freely.
Twitter in Turkey is like a war zone. They have actually assembled a police team for that, just for tracking Twitter, yeah. It's been in the paper. They don't deny it. I don't know whether I should laugh or cry.
So as I headed back to school in September, John reported less and less protesting, but his passions are still strong as he continues to send me updates over Facebook chat. Nearby in Cairo, Karim sees an interim president that continues to promise the heightened level of democracy that he desires, yet he still remains distressed as headlines continue to emerge, such as Egypt interim president defends military coup from Al Jazeera. All the way in Brazil, Patricia continues her studies, feeling her city eerily return to normalcy, with bus prices stagnant at 3 reais. In each case, the inner desire of these youths to strive towards democracy and social justice in their countries have not been quenched. For War News Radio, I'm Sadie Rittman.
This is War News Radio. When President Obama promised to scale back U.S. drone strikes targeting militants in Yemen, they stopped for a full 7 weeks, only to start again after one militant group issued a high-profile threat. War News Radio's Amy DiPiero finds out why a terror threat hyped in the U.S. barely raised eyebrows in Yemen.
Abdulghani al-Iryani was chatting with some farmers at an end of Ramadan celebration in Raraa, Yemen, when he found himself in a familiar corner. Local Islamic militant group Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP for short, had left this town just 100 miles southeast of the capital a year and a half before, but farmers were still lamenting their retreat to the mountains.
They were very happy to see AQAP come to their area because the commander of AQAP, Farak al-Zahab, was a charismatic person who immediately started dealing with long-standing local conflicts.
Things like who has access to scarce water resources or who has the rights to certain plots of land.
One of them kept repeating that he was an angel.
Iriani had heard this kind of talk before. A political analyst currently helping the UN to investigate how drone strikes affect civilians, Iriani says peasant farmers in other provinces occupied by AQAP, the same areas targeted by U.S. drone strikes usually, are often thankful to have the group around.
The failure of government to respond to the needs of people made AQAP the only other option.
After Yemenis ousted President Ali Abdullah Saleh in 2012, they hoped a new government would establish local law and bring basic services to the most impoverished parts of the country. But progress so far has been slow, and often AQAP has filled the power vacuum in the meantime. And the drone strikes, headline-grabbing events here in the West, continue. The U.S. responded to one AQAP threat this summer by renewing strikes after a nearly two-month ceasefire. For most Yemenis, the terror alert was a sideshow to the more urgent hunger and thirst they face every day.
Tens and hundreds of thousands of children today, if not millions of children, are stunted, are malnourished to the extent where it affects their physical growth, but their mental growth.
Peter Salisbury is an analyst for the Yemen Forum at London-based think tank Chatham House.
In the not-too-distant future, Al-Qaeda will maybe be the least of people's concerns.
Salisbury says it's no surprise that the poorest would welcome Al-Qaeda or anyone else offering them help, especially when it seems they can't trust politicians in the faraway capital.
The only thing that a lot of people know of their own government, let alone foreign governments, is that it doesn't provide electricity, it doesn't provide water or schooling or other services, but it does allow another country to attack.
Iriani says the challenges of poverty stop Yemenis not directly affected by drone strikes from organizing against them.
On the one hand, you have people who are completely occupied with their loss to a drone, and then just a short distance away, nobody cares.
It's not just a question of which town is hit and which is not. Iriani says nobody mentioned drone strikes or the U.S. during his visit to Ladakh because a nearby explosion had killed six people just weeks before. The strike brought silence. For War News Radio, I'm Amy DePiro.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Fatima Bouzar-Jomeri, Maggie Christ, Patrick Han, Asma Nore, Varun Prasad, Tyler Welsh, and Chloe Wittenberg. Our piece editors are Amy DiPiero, Varun Prasad, and Sabrina Singh. I'm Kat Galvis.
And I'm Jay Clayton. Until next time, thanks for listening.